Chapter 6 Whither AIDS? The most talked about medical phenomena of the 1980s is AIDS, the acquired immune deficiency syndrome. The name is of some interest. First of all, it is said to be acquired, presuming some action on the part of the victim in coming down with this disease. Second, it results in or is characterized by an immune deficiency, meaning that the human system loses the ability to fight against and overcome these inimical presences. The result is that the system becomes prey to a variety of infections, some of which will be fatal. The prevalence of these infections occurs through two dominant illnesses, Kaposi's sarcoma, evidenced by large sores on the skin, and a form of pneumonia. It is noteworthy that pneumonia, which had been a fatal disease, had largely been conquered. It had been called the old man's friend, because it took off many elderly persons who presumably no longer had a desire to live. The class of infections which have become widespread through what is called AIDS were first recognized by physicians, veterinarians and biologists about 50 years ago. At that time, many sheep in Ireland were afflicted by a killer epidemic called Medesvisma. Biologists determined that Medesvisma was caused by a new class of viruses. Because of the time they required to become virulent, these viruses were called slow viruses. The advent of these slow viruses presages a new era in the medical history of mankind. Human beings prior to this time have not been affected by slow viruses, although they have been found among animals being transmissible among monkeys and apes. Slow viruses are also a type known as retroviruses. When they enter an infected cell, they assimilate into the genetic structure of the cell, apparently during the cell process of mitosis, or cell division, such division being a normal process of healthy growth. Mitosis is one of the two alternatives which face every cell in the human body. Either it divides and grows through mitosis, as a life process, or it submits to viral replication and resultant cell death, as part of a disease process. Thus we find at the crux of the AIDS problem the ultimate question of the life or death of the entire organism. This is why AIDS, once it reaches the virulent stage, is said to be incurable, resulting in the death of the host body. In a healthy body, some 10 million cells are dying every second. At this same second, they are usually replaced by the body process. Such immediate replacement cannot be orchestrated by the usual body processes of genetic information theories, chromosomes, 103-point enzymes or nerve impulse signals. The instantaneous nature of the process requires that it be commanded by biradiation phenomena. These are triggered by coherent ultra-weak photon emissions from living tissues of varying wavelengths. These photon emissions, according to their wavelengths, control biological functions which are in constant activity, such as phetorpor, phonoxism, phonoperiodic clocks, mitosis, and multifidon events. Ultra-weak photon emissions from living cells exhibit a spectral distribution from infrared, 900 nm, to ultraviolet, 200 nm. This photon intensity correlates with the conformational states of DNA, during which activity the spectral intensities of biophotons amount to magnitudes of some 10 over 40 magnitude times higher than those of thermal equilibrium at physiological temperatures. The biomolecule with the highest information density, DNA, seems to be the source of biophoton regulatory radiation, functioning as an exciplex laser, and comparing favorably with the fields of man-made lasers. Thus the problem of AIDS brings us to the most basic properties of cell function. The ability of the living cell to respond to microwaves without discernible variation in temperature apparently indicates a non-thermal mechanism like an activated crystal. Thus AIDS may help us in understanding the tuning mechanism of cells, which indicate its state of health or disease and thus improve our understanding of all diseases affecting the organism. A wide-ranging study of living cells, from primitive bacteria to those of man, shows that these cells produce natural alternating current, AC, fields which in frequency ranges lower than 100 MHz, show maximal electrical oscillation at or near mitosis. Here again, tuned systems are triggering biological actions in a manner which is not yet fully understood. Thus the death of Rock Hudson, one of Hollywood's most promiscuous homosexual psychopaths, may lead to the fortunate result of inspiring new breakthroughs in our understanding of the most basic cell functions. Unfortunately, the cancer profiteers and medical monopoly insist on treating AIDS as a malfunction of the cell itself, which, of course, calls for the magic bullet, the chemotherapy which will be provided at a price by the drug trust. In fact, chemotherapy attacks the immune system, thus increasing the fatality of the disease. The establishment approach is to attack the virus, not to aid the system in overcoming it, thus not only bypassing the immune system which is already under attack from this disease, but actually aiding in its conquest. There have been repeated claims that AIDS is actually a man-made virus. It seems to have been unknown prior to 1976, when mild traces of it were discovered in African blood banks. Available evidence indicates that it then began spreading throughout Africa, and subsequently to the United States, during the mid-70s. A possible reference to this or some other created virus appears in the WHO Bulletin, V47, page 251 in 1972. An attempt should be made to see if viruses can in fact exert selective effects on immune function. The possibility should be looked into that the immune 104-point response to the virus itself may be impaired if the infecting virus damages, more or less selectively, the cell responding to the virus. Carlton Gajisk, National Institute of Health Director at Fort Detrick, noted, "In the facility I have a building where more good and loyal communists, scientists from the USSR and mainland China work, with full passkeys to all the laboratories, than there are Americans. Even the Army's infectious disease unit is loaded with foreign workers, not always friendly nationals. This fuels speculation that such a virus could have been created by alien and unfriendly scientists working in the heart of our own defense laboratories, whether as a plan to decimate our population, or as one more step towards ultimate world domination." From 1976 to 1981, AIDS was almost exclusively publicly identified as a disease of homosexuals, thus the general population felt no alarm at problems confined to a relatively small group. The few non-homosexuals who came down with AIDS acquired it from public blood banks, through homosexuals who had sold their blood. AIDS was then termed gay cancer by doctors who informed patients they had the disease. It was usually unmistakable because of large purplish blotches which disfigured the skin, proof of the presence of Kaposi's sarcoma. At this time, many doctors believed the disease originated in the peculiar physical factors of homosexual activity, with considerable evidence pointing to the use of fatty lubricants in rectal intercourse. These lubricants, introduced into the intestinal area in this unusual manner, apparently, provided a fertile breeding ground for the onslaught of the infection. Dr. Lawrence Burden, a noted cancer specialist, raised the question, "What effect does repeated and sustained introduction of lubricants into the anal cavity have upon the immune system?" It was noted that this caused immune depression in test animals. Burden's attorney, W.H. Moore, suggested that hydrogenated fats, either consumed orally or used anally, could cause AIDS. This again brings us back to the role which nutrition plays in any disease, such as the victims of atomic radiation in Japan. Those on traditional low-fat diet suffered substantially fewer fatalities than those on the modern high-fat diet. This also raises again the question of hydrogenated fats and their possible deleterious effect upon the human system, either heated, which produces dangerous chemical changes, or ingested cold. The initial reaction of many homosexuals, on being informed that they had AIDS, was what has been termed by psychologists, homosexual rage, a dementia in which the patient is possessed by a mad desire for revenge. The phenomenon of this type of AIDS dementia has been observed in some 60% of AIDS patients, bolstering some doctors' belief that AIDS is merely a new variant on the ancient syphilis infection. Syphilis often is characterized by paresis, deterioration of the brain until schizophrenia takes over. Other physicians have related AIDS dementia to toxoplasmosis, a cat-borne parasite which causes the same type of dementia which afflicts patients with AIDS. The problem with pursuing any of these leads is that not only is the medical monopoly waiting in the wings 105-point to reap more billions of dollars in profits from this new epidemic, but the civil libertarians are forestalling investigations of AIDS by defending the privacy of its victims. Like other groups which either have offended society or have purposefully cut themselves off from what is termed society, homosexuals have developed a fanatical group loyalty. Many homosexual activists see in AIDS one more representation of the fundamental differences which create an insurmountable barrier between themselves and other humans. As such, they are exploiting it and perhaps are reluctant to see any solution to AIDS. This group loyalty has manifested itself in a telling way, the determination of many homosexuals with AIDS to infect as many people as possible, not only through greatly extending their already voluminous sexual contacts, but also by infecting others through their bartered blood. In Los Angeles, a James Markovsky, who was then in the final stages of AIDS, was arrested June 23, 1987 for selling his blood to the Los Angeles Plasma Production Associates. He admitted that he wanted to infect as many people as possible before he died. On January 7, 1987, a notorious homosexual activist, Robert Schwab, who was also dying of AIDS, made a public appeal to all his confreres that gay males should immediately give blood if they had been diagnosed as having AIDS. "Whatever action is required to get national attention is valid," he declared. "If that includes blood terrorism, so be it." It was noted that following Schwab's widely advertised public appeal, blood donations increased by a dramatic 300% in New York and San Francisco, the two queenly centers of American homosexuality. None other than Rock Hudson, when he was informed that he had AIDS, was overcome with homosexual rage. He immediately launched on a frenetic campaign to infect as many people as possible, concentrating on teenagers who had no idea of the dangers they were facing. In his insane determination to leave this world in a sexual bonheur-dameron, Hudson must have infected dozens, if not hundreds, of unsuspecting youths. Even today, lawsuits are still pending against his estate, as a result of his orgy of fear and hate. While the Rock Hudsons were dying their slow and agonizing deaths, most members of the American public viewed them with a mixture of approbation and contempt. There was no fear, because, as yet, there was no indication of peril to the population at large. However, as early as September 16, 1983, at a health conference in Washington, D.C., the question was raised by Dr. John Groerhaus: will AIDS become another bubonic plague? The conference supplied the finding that AIDS can be the harbinger of a series of Holocaustal epidemics. On September 26, 1985, Dr. William Hasseltine of Harvard Medical School reported that an estimated 10 million Africans were now infected with the AIDS virus. However, government authorities here continued to assure the public that AIDS was limited to four groups: homosexuals, Haitians, intravenous drug users, and blacks. Since most American citizens 106 points would never come into direct contact with any of these groups, a fetid subinverculus which existed in its own twilight world of filth and degeneracy, it seemed that the AIDS epidemic would never become a threat to the American middle class. The government agency, the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, the heroes of the Great Swine Flu Massacre, now did their best to keep the American people in the dark as to a possible spread of AIDS. They issued periodic ukases to the effect that AIDS could not be spread by insects, AIDS could not be contracted by kissing, although they admitted that the AIDS virus was present in saliva, and other reassurances whose scientific validity seems to have been taken directly from the pages of Grimm's fairy tales. Even so, CDC estimated that by 1988, from 1 to 1.5 million Americans would be infected with the AIDS virus. There were already 5,890 members of the U.S. Army who were infected with AIDS. Dr. David Axelrod, Commissioner of Health for the state of New York, solemnly warned that all those who had the AIDS virus were doomed. Virtually all those infected are doomed. Dr. John Sale, of Richmond, Virginia, presided at a conference June 11, 1987, in which he stated positively that AIDS is not a sexually transmitted disease. It is a contagious disease which is also transmitted in blood. He denounced the Surgeon General of the United States, Dr. Everett Koop, for deliberately spreading disinformation about the disease, claiming that joining Koop in this campaign of scientific disinformation were Sir Donald Acheson, Chief Medical Officer of the United Kingdom, Dr. Halfdan Mahler, Director General of the World Health Organization, Dr. Robert Gallo of the National Institute of Health, and Professor Viktor Zhdanov, Director of the Ivanovsky Institute of Virology in Moscow. Dr. Sale was not the first to point the finger at Dr. Gallo, resident scientist of the National Institute of Health, who was famed as having discovered the humanal immunodeficiency virus, HIV, which he claimed was the cause of AIDS. After Gallo's discovery, the NIH, which doles out funds for research on AIDS as well as many other categories, consistently denied funds to any scientist whose work failed to bear out Gallo's claim. President Reagan then appointed a special presidential commission on AIDS, which was intended to solve the problem. It tried to do so by meeting in great secrecy, and by meeting without a quorum, so that no notes could be taken of the proceedings. Admiral James D. Watkins was head of these meetings, which came in for much criticism, merely because the American public wanted to know what was being accomplished. One of the researchers who was to come into conflict with Dr. Gallo over the HIV controversy is Dr. Peter Duisberg, professor of virology at the University of California at Berkeley. Duisberg is also a member of the National Academy of Sciences. He had been brought to Gallo's own laboratory to work under a fellowship grant. After studying HIV in the same laboratory, where Gallo had claimed to have made his monumental findings, Dr. Duisberg concluded that the HIV virus did not meet the standard criteria required of a 107-disease-causing agent. He published his findings in the medical journal, Cancer Research, in March 1987, and sat back to wait for Dr. Gallo to justify his conclusions. Both he and the editor of Cancer Research, Dr. Peter McGee, were amazed when Dr. Gallo made no reply, either then or in the ensuing months. Dr. Gallo also refused to return telephone calls seeking to elicit some reaction to Duisberg's findings. Apparently, it was one of those famous fact or fiction researches in which Dr. Gallo had claimed to pinpoint the HIV virus as the sole cause of AIDS. This sort of thing occurs more often than anyone realizes in the academic and scientific world, which is riddled with petty jealousies, calculated deceit, and denial of funds to anyone who might expose their fake research. As we mentioned earlier, most scientists, when asked for their research notes, usually respond that they have been accidentally burned. Whether anyone has ever seen any of Dr. Gallo's work isolating the HIV virus is not known. However, he has since moved to cut off any further studies of the HIV virus. Dr. Harvey Bailey, research editor of the medical journal Bio/Technology, had organized a White House workshop on the subject, How Does HIV Cause AIDS? It was to be co-hosted by Jim Warner, a senior analyst for domestic policy at the White House. It was expected that Dr. Gallo would attend this conference and present some substantiation of his claims. Warner had already become very skeptical of Gallo after reviewing Dr. Duisberg's findings. But Gallo never appeared. Instead, the White House conference, which was scheduled for January 19, 1988, was abruptly cancelled without explanation. Hundreds of millions of dollars continue to be awarded each year to pursue Gallo's questionable claim that the HIV virus causes AIDS. However, no funds are awarded to those who wish to challenge his claims. Dr. Duisberg has had some interesting experiences, since he unwittingly challenged one of the nation's leading bureaucratic scientists. The Presidential Committee on the HIV Virus Epidemic invited him to a special meeting in New York, which was covered by the Wall Street Journal scientific writer Katie Ledishman. A staff member of this meeting admitted that Duisberg was invited to appear to discredit him. This goal was thwarted when none of the members of the Presidential Commission could answer any of Dr. Duisberg's findings. They consoled themselves by sharply reprimanding him for having challenged Gallo's work. Dr. William Walsh, who is president of Project Hope and perennial standard bearer of establishment values, strongly admonished Duisberg, "Don't confuse the public. Don't confuse the poor people suffering from this disease." Duisberg was himself confused by this approach, as he had never sought to confuse anyone. He had merely pursued a scientific approach which brought into disrepute the leading government scientist. If this upset a presidential commission, whose sole function seemed to be to protect Dr. Gallo, this could hardly be Dr. Duisberg's fault. As we commented, the 108-point entire imbroglio typifies what passes for serious scientific work in America. Ms. Ledishman characterized the episode as that of instant orthodoxy which resists review. Meanwhile, due to the lack of real scientific verification of any single cause, a number of theories about the origin of AIDS have sprung up. These range from the previously mentioned suggestion that it is a new variation on the syphilis spirochete, to a variation of hepatitis virus, which has been endemic for some years, to its kinship with the Epstein-Barr virus, a member of the herpes viridae. This is probably the most widely disseminated human virus today, affecting some 95% of the world's population. It is usually transmitted through saliva. Young people come down with it as infectious mononucleosis. Its consequences include hepatitis and splenomegaly, with complications of Reye syndrome, Guillain-Barré syndrome, Bell's palsy, and chronic fever and fatigue. Its effects are often mistaken by physicians for multiple sclerosis, Hodgkin's disease, leukemia and lupus. Dr. Stephen Kaza of New York is one of those who identify AIDS as the latest manifestation of syphilis, a logical determination, in view of the fact that it occurs frequently among very promiscuous homosexuals and prostitutes. During the first quarter of 1987, recorded cases of syphilis jumped by 23%, the largest increase in a decade. Dr. Peter Duisberg is so positive that there is another agent for AIDS that he has offered to be publicly injected with the AIDS virus. Chuck Ortlieb voices another widely held concept, that AIDS is but one variation of the widely encountered chronic fatigue syndrome, the Epstein-Barr syndrome, which is now worldwide. Other researchers are certain that AIDS is merely one more consequence of the Great Swine Flu Massacre, when the population was injected with the swine flu vaccine. Correlations between AIDS and the real swine flu, that is, a version of this disease which has been observed among swine, have now been established. Other researchers have blamed a more dramatic or accidental variation of a hepatitis serum which was widely distributed a few years ago. However, none of these theories can compare in narrative value with the green monkey theory. According to this theory, which had long been a favorite explanation advanced by the government propaganda group, the Center for Disease Control, for years a tribe of little green monkeys has roamed in Central Africa. Showing little fear of humans, they have often strayed into native villages. These green monkeys carry in their bloodstream a type of the AIDS virus, to which they are seemingly immune. However, the little green monkeys have either been native women or had intercourse with them. Depending on which story you wish to believe, the native women's systems then activated the AIDS virus, and later infected their husbands, who then went to Haiti, where they were paid to perform as male prostitutes by members of the American homosexual population who frequently visited Haiti for amusement. These homosexuals 109 point then returned to New York, infecting the New York community, and commuting to San Francisco, where they spread the disease on the West Coast. This scenario is claimed to have taken place within a few weeks, from green monkey to homosexuals dying with AIDS in San Francisco. However, most researchers believe the disease took quite a few years to reach its present epidemic stage. A response to the AIDS epidemic was made difficult by the fact that it was confined to the homosexuals, poor blacks, and intravenous drug users, who were known by the slogan "Nothing degenerate is alien to me." The disease became prevalent at the same time that the homosexual movement was emerging as a powerful political force. Allying themselves with blacks, militant homosexuals, for all practical purposes, took over the Democratic Party, to the dismay of active heterosexuals like Senator Teddy Kennedy. The traditional leaders of the Democratic Party now began to fear publicity about AIDS as originating from the Republican Party, which could pose as the party of sexual normality. There is little doubt that the conquest of the Democratic Party by the WACUS, wresting it away from its long-standing mafia control, was a boon to the Republicans. The result was that the Democrats fought desperately to keep AIDS in the closet, battling any proposals for AIDS testing or other government measures to control its spread. In San Francisco, a plan to close the bathhouses, the nation's most famous homosexual bordellos, had originated with some of the more frightened homosexuals, who had already seen their lovers wither away and die from the disease. Their suggestion was met with a chorus of outrage from the hardcore homos, who were loyally supported by San Francisco's political leaders. It had long been established that the homosexual vote now provided the crucial swing vote needed for victory in San Francisco, and they were not about to give up their political power. On the national level, government efforts to deal with AIDS have been limited to pathetic and laughable programs to hand out free condoms and free drug needles to the suicidal fringe among the degenerates. In fact, by these tactics, government agencies themselves became official sponsors of homosexual degeneracy and use of narcotics, a strange development for the upholders of the statutes. reflecting the government's new and more enlightened approach. Bird's Florist, in the nation's capital, celebrated Valentine's Day, 1988 by offering a Valentine special, consisting of a dozen American Beauty roses, and a dozen condoms. The package, which was called the Safe Sex Bouquet, was received with enthusiasm by the government bureaucracy. Throughout this epidemic, the government has done virtually nothing, while AIDS continues to spread. The Center for Disease Control, in Jimmy Carter's backyard, had continued to be dominated by old-line Democratic politicians. Any cooperation with the fascist regime of Ronald Reagan was refused. From the outset of the AIDS epidemic, the Center for Disease Control has thought a desperate rearguard action to conceal or play down the epidemic. In 110. The summer of 1985, CDC authorities flatly refused to consider head lice or pubic lice as possible transmitters of the AIDS virus. CDC staff members rejected the idea with horror, lisping that the very notion was impracticable and frightening. In fact, it is well known that many viruses are carried by insects, especially arboviruses, arthropod-borne viruses. Some 500 of these arboviruses have now been identified. Some researchers are certain that the bedbug is one of the principal carriers of the AIDS virus, which is spreading so rapidly throughout Africa. The bedbug is found in almost every African hut. Scientists now believe that mosquitoes, the tsetse fly, the line ant, and black beetles may also be transmitting the AIDS virus in Africa. This offers a rational explanation for the rapid spread of AIDS in many different African countries. None of these insects can be found in all African countries, but one or more are present in large numbers in every region of Africa. In 1900, Dr. Walter Reed proved that the Aedes aegypti mosquito was the vector for yellow fever. It is now known that some monkeys do carry an AIDS type of virus, but as Dr. Duisberg discovered, the HIV virus, to which Dr. Gallo of Nice attributes sole responsibility for AIDS infection, is only present in about half of all AIDS cases, a factor which Dr. Gallo forbears to explain. The question is, what is the infecting agent in the other half of the AIDS cases? Or, as Dr. Duisberg states, the HIV virus is not the infecting agent in any of them. If this is the case, then the massive government testing programs for the presence of the HIV virus are a multi-million dollar hue and cry after false trails. Although the Center for Disease Control has continued to insist that poverty, environment, and insects all have absolutely nothing to do with AIDS transmission, an advertisement appeared May 1987 in Science magazine seeking a research entomologist who would study the possible role of biting arthropods in transmitting human immunodeficiency, AIDS, virus. Apply to the Center for Disease Control. The perils of offending preconceived theories about AIDS continue to dog researchers. When the Institute of Tropical Medicine presented the results of research it had concluded there, and which indicated there was an arboviral connection to AIDS, the University of Michigan, under considerable pressure from the Center for Disease Control, promptly cut off all of their funding. At Oxford, on August 25, 1986, Professor Jean-Claude Sermon of Paris Pasteur Institute reported that AIDS had been found in African insects. The virus had been isolated in mosquitoes, cockroaches, ants and tsetse flies. This was a direct contradiction to the claims of the CDC that the AIDS virus could not be carried by mosquitoes or any other insects. California physician Bruce Halsted, M.D., states that modern medicine has no cure for AIDS, cancer or radiation sickness. He also points out that his research establishes that the AIDS virus is capable of 1 trillion mutations. Meanwhile, AIDS patients who 111. Are being treated by oncologists, cancer specialists are reported to be dying at a much greater rate than AIDS patients who are being treated by holistic methods. Many of them are surprising medical statisticians by surviving longer than the 2-year time span allotted after the diagnosis of the disease. One 40-year-old patient in San Francisco, Dan Turner, is now the longest surviving victim of AIDS. He says he was infected during a trip to New York in June 1981, and on February 12, 1982, he was informed by a physician that he had gay cancer, after developing the unmistakable symptoms of Kaposi's sarcoma. He had observed a regimen of vitamin C, natural foods, meditation, acupuncture, and weightlifting. Lawrence Badgley, M.D., in his groundbreaking work, Healing AIDS Naturally, offers a number of treatments, a typical one having shown good results with a vegetarian diet of vegetables, vitamins, wheatgrass, juice and herbs, which is accompanied by 8 or 9 cloves of raw garlic each day. While the government fiddles, the American public continues to burn at the thought of being infected with AIDS, a fatal disease. Referees at boxing matches and other blood sports now wear medical gloves to avoid being infected by spattering blood from the contestants. Court officials don protective clothing such as gloves and surgical masks when forced to appear in court with diseased AIDS victims. These accoutrements arouse rage and horror from civil libertarians, who claim these protective techniques create a harmful atmosphere for the AIDS patient. Since he is probably already dying, the argument would seem to be moot. The established fact that from its outset, the AIDS epidemic was confined to the well-identified groups of homosexuals, Haitians, intravenous drug users, and blacks, has also created a furor at the American Civil Liberties Union, it being a precept of egalitarian society that a disease should not be so bigoted in choosing its victims. In New York State prisons from 1984 to 1986, the toll of AIDS victims was 45% Hispanic, 43% Black, with 97% of them being intravenous drug users, New York Times, February 7, 1988. This writer having previously established in The Curse of Canaan that homosexuality, from the time of Canaan himself to the present day, has had its origins in pollution of the original root race, the confusion of sexual identity being a direct consequence of the resulting confusion of racial identity, confusing the DNA pattern of the genetic structure, it is hardly surprising to find in Joyce Kuhlenberg's useful book, Complete Guide to Gay Parenting, Doubleday 1985, that gay couples who are white are found to adopt almost exclusively black children. This is unfair to the black adoptees, who, through no fault of their own, will then be exposed to the possibility of contracting AIDS from one or the other of their gay foster parents. It would seem that gay whites are unwilling to expose other whites to the perils of the alternative lifestyle. 112.